Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Anlu Kierba. Let's get into the news of today, and we're going to be talking a little bit about hijacked buildings and property rights in South Africa, and how these are actually working in practice. I think it's an important thing to consider, because we often, I think, get caught up in some of the discussions over the laws, policies, which are all very important, don't get me wrong, but if things on the ground are completely different, then that's also worth taking into consideration. I would also just like to say that next Monday, the 8th, we'll be having our last sort of normalist show for the year. We're going to be doing a live YouTube show at 1 o'clock on Monday. It will, you know, obviously stay up, but if you're interested in tuning in, please do. We'll have a nice big panel, and we'll discuss some things that viewers bring up, and we'll talk about the year that's been and the year ahead. Okay. Well, let's get into our news story today, and we're going to start this off with a discussion of a building hijacking in Johannesburg. Now, anyone who has paid attention to the news in Johannesburg knows that there's quite a few hijacked buildings around the city. Johannesburg has at least 400 hijacked buildings. Most of them are in the city center, in places like Hillbrow. A hijacked building is basically where the owner is not there or not exercising full control over it, and a syndicate rolls in, fills it with tenants, and then claims all the rents from that place, basically completely stealing it. But it's not just the inner city where buildings are subject to hijackings. There was a story in News 24 about a house in Bryanston, which is a nice suburb. She went on the owner's wife went on holiday in 2020, and when she left the house, 100 people were brought into the house by a guy called Lawrence Romalwa, who then proceeded to turn it into essentially a giant slum. There are apparently now 70 families living on this property. I presume it's quite a big property based on the sort of area it's in. And the entire garden is filled with these sort of wooden Zozo huts. Every single room, there's 41 Zozo huts now allegedly there, occupied by families, 33 rooms in the actual house itself. The owner claims that this guy who is apparently running this slum earns about 164,000 rand a month from this property. They are selling basically space in the kitchen or whatever for 3,500 rand. A lot of this information comes from the owner who says that she paid one of the tenants money basically to scout for her inside the house and tell her what was going on. When the media contacted this guy who allegedly is running this place, he had first claimed that he was working with the property owner to buy the place, and he only had one Zozo hut for a worker, and there was nothing wrong going here. You know, he was just renting this property out, and but no one's allowed into the property, so it's no one can check. And when the owner contacted the police, contacted the city, the response seems to have been, huh? Well, that doesn't sound good. Oh, well. And just kind of a bit of a shrug. Now that it's in the media, there's some sort of promises that the member of the mayoral committee for public safety might do an oversight visit to the house. And City Power says they're going to be investigating illegal connections and that sort of stuff going on in this house. But the reality is that this person's property rights, even though this is obviously completely illegal, are just not being protected. And yesterday we talked about, you know, how much poorer South Africans living in Kimberley basically just had their houses flooded with sewage. Their rights to their property were not really protected. Here we have a house being taken over and law enforcement apparently just not doing anything. A liquidator there's a divorce going on that involves this house. A court-appointed liquidator was tasked with liquidating the property to divide the profit from the sale of the house equally. However, the liquidator was not able to enter the property and has failed to proceed with the liquidation. This invasion happened in 2020. And so this matter has not been resolved in 5 years. Anlu, I mean, one bad case like this, sure, but the problem is this is systemic. This is the reality of property rights over large portions of South Africa. What's your take on this?
Even just reading it, I felt like I was stuck in a nightmare. I cannot imagine what the owner of this property must feel like. To go on holiday and return and not be able to enter your own home, which you own, you have the title deed for, to have a security guard at the gate tell you that there's no way for you to enter your own property, sounds like an absolute nightmare. The only way that this happens is if people think that they can get away with it. And that is the entire problem we are often referring to on the podcast when we talk about why it is so important to protect people's property rights. And to not even edge towards taking away property rights. Because the moment you even introduce the idea of perhaps being able to take property, people realize that there's an opportunity for them to get a good argument and to explain why perhaps it's a good idea to take this property. And then if you add on top of this, the fact that we have a very bad policing system, we have inefficient municipalities. I mean, now that there's some media attention 5 years later, there's promises to go do inspections. Now only. If you add on top of taking away people's property rights or just talking about taking away property rights, you add on top of that all these horrible, all these inefficient systems that we already have, I'm not surprised that these people have for 5 years struggled to get back their own property. I am astonished that they've now turned it into 33 rooms. There are very serious health concerns, firstly. The fact that they, in this article, they explain how there are at least three people living in the kitchen, which immediately means that these people live here. This is where this is their home. Where do they make food? Where do they use the lavatory? All those things need to happen in other areas, which has major, major health concerns. The fact that there has been no inspections, you can see 77 families. You see multiple people entering and leaving that property a day. There is ample opportunity for an inspector to say, listen, we just heard. What about the neighbors even? I'm actually surprised that no neighbor has filed a complaint, because to have 77 people on one property also means that there's likely a lot of noise. There has just been no regulation or no inspection. And now, as you said, they are saying that, oh, this does sound bad. This sounds like it's not normal. No, of course it's not normal. It's not supposed to be the case. And you mentioned that it's a systemic problem. I've also come across a few other stories that has also gotten ample media attention of where this is not only the case in well-off neighborhoods. They are not only taking big homes, they are also taking the homes of the average and the poor households. I've seen quite a few stories of gogos, older ladies, having their title deeds. One of these specific instances, the lady shared with, I think it was News 24, her proof that she paid off her bond. She paid it off. She has her title deed. And they still took her home. She used to have a three-bedroom apartment or house. She now lives in a one-bedroom, literally apartment with her bed and her kitchen right next to each other. After she spent her entire life savings, a majority of her monthly income on paying off that bond to secure something for herself and her two sons, there was no protection for what she worked for. And that is what is so incredibly concerning regarding not having a clear and definitive line on people's property rights. I am genuinely concerned by the story. Not surprised, but concerned.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, you know, this affects people all over South Africa. I know a story of a woman, also an older woman, who was chucked out of her house. I think it was an RDP house by her own daughter, who was involved in drugs, and had this like bad boyfriend, and they basically just threw their own mother out of the house, even though she was supposed to be the owner of this. This is a woman who had basically nothing. She had to go live in a shack after this. And, you know, when approaching law enforcement to deal with something that is obviously illegal, it was, whatever, go home, Gorgor, you're wasting our time here. So, I mean, this is, I think, a reminder that, you know, we not only need, as you say, kind of good laws and a firm line from the state on saying, no, this is, you know, you need to protect your property rights, but we also need the law enforcement operations to take this seriously. I wouldn't be surprised if someone in government had actually at some point noticed that there was something going wrong here and had maybe just been bribed to look the other way. Unfortunately, you know, all of these, whenever there's a government, an investigation into any government department, so often we find the syndicates have infiltrated it. I wouldn't be surprised if the same thing is happening with regards to these building hijackers. Terrible stuff. But, you know, this is exactly the impact that the loss of property rights has on people. I mean, if you can know, if you know that your property, due to bad luck, due to the fact that you are, I don't know, you trust your house to someone you maybe shouldn't have trusted it to look after it while you're not there. If that can result in the complete destruction of your asset, how likely are you going to be to invest heavily in stuff? And that, of course, has ripple effects through the whole economy. You know, property rights really are key to prosperity for not just the rich, but the poor too. If you don't have property, you're more likely to be able to get property and improve your position if property rights are secure. You cannot end poverty or just general chaos, which we have in South Africa, without stable property rights.
The thing is also, these people who now pay 3,500 rand rent or who live in these 44 Wendy houses, which I have no idea how there is building plans approved for plumbing and whatnot, which I'm assuming there isn't.
Well, yeah, there probably isn't any plumbing at all.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, these are the people who the government, and with that I'm including local government, municipalities, and provincial governments, are saying that they are protecting these people. They are trying, by giving these people properties or by taking away properties from other people, these are the people that they want to benefit. But in practice, these are the people who benefit the least from these type of practices and from weak property rights for exactly that reason you just explained, for them to actually own their own property and to not have to live in one third of the kitchen. You have to actually ensure that there is strong property rights for that gogo or woman who puts her entire life savings towards her three-bedroom house. That is the person for who we need to protect property rights.
So there is another aspect to this as well, which is, you know, why are people paying 3,500 rand to live in a third of a kitchen or in a unplumbed, outside shack? And I think one of the reasons for that is because housing is pretty expensive, and housing close to stuff that is economic activity is also pretty expensive. The people working, I mean, the guy who is apparently giving this information to the owner is I think he was an Uber driver or something who was living on this property. So it's, you know, Uber drivers can often work quite long hours, and, you know, you want to be close to where your customers are, so you spend less on petrol, that sort of thing. So let's move on to our second story while we talk about the cost of housing. There have been some calls recently in the pages of Ground Up, where an op-ed was recently written titled "Cape Town Needs Rent Control. Here are six ways we could do it." And with the election of the sort of democratic socialist mayor in New York, Zoran Mamdani. There's been this little bit of sort of media activist buzz about maybe we need rent control because that's one of the things he's proposed for New York City. And a lot of people around the world are, you know, including South Africa and especially in Cape Town, are saying, well, you know, maybe we should consider rent control. Maybe we should consider trying to bring government in to reduce the costs of housing. Everyone from, you know, someone on the lower end to the upper end is really feeling, I think, the pain right now of high property prices. Anlu and I are both renters in Cape Town, so we are sort of in this category. But there's been this, what I think was a pretty good op-ed written response to that one I mentioned in Ground Up by Mayor of Cape Town, Jordan Hill Lewis, titled, Rent Control Not Only Fails, It Entrenches Inequality. So I'm just going to read sections of this. The solution to housing affordability is to increase supply by building more housing. When it comes to housing costs, there is often a temptation in the public debate to reach for quick fixes that sound like they promise relief without exception deliver only disappointment. Every thriving global city confronts rising demand, limited land, and escalating prices, and Cape Town, a city whose growing appeal is undeniable, is no exception. So as frustration mounts, so do calls for rent caps, foreign buyer restrictions, and heavy-handed interventions that have failed everywhere they have been tried. At moments like this, the city deserves a discussion rooted in evidence and economic reality rather than political theater. The proposal to cap rental prices is an emotionally satisfying argument, but it is also wrong, and not just theoretically wrong, but demonstrably, repeatedly, historically wrong. This has been proven in every city that has tried to price control its way out of housing scarcity. He goes on to say that Cape Town is an increasingly successful city economically and culturally, and like every successful city in modern history, its biggest housing problem is simple. Too much demand is chasing too little supply. The only solution to housing affordability is either to reduce demand, which would mean becoming poorer, less attractive, less safe, and less economically dynamic, or you increase supply by building more housing. That's it. There is no magic third option. It talks about various cities where rent controls were tried and didn't succeed because inevitably what happens when you try to cap the price of how much you're allowed to charge for rent is landlords respond in two ways. They either don't build new housing because it's not that profitable, or they skip on maintenance. They say, well, you know, if I can't charge more, then I'm just going to let sort of nature take its course as far as possible. And if you bring in more regulations to say, no, you have to maintain a house up to this stage, people just sell these assets because they're not worth it. They're not worth the hassle. Jordan Hill Lewis ends this by saying, if we are serious about improving affordability, we must also be honest about where the blockages reside. Social housing is funded by national government subsidies and human settlements grants, not municipal budgets. The city's role is to create conditions for delivery by releasing land on a discounted basis, streamlining approvals, providing bulk services, and offering incentives to social housing institutions and micro developers. Cape Town is doing this at a scale unmatched by any metro. We will not deliver affordability. What will not deliver affordability are the familiar political distinctions such as rent caps, foreign buyer restrictions, or attempts to regulate prices downwards. None of these measures build new homes. They've failed everywhere they've been tried and would fail here too. We'll solve our challenges by freeing up more building more urgently and more ambitiously. So let's leave Airbnbs and these short-term rental things aside for a moment, because I think we have views on that we can discuss. I think this is very correct, and I'm very glad to see Mayor Jordan Hill Lewis saying this. The problem is that when you have a city that works, or doesn't even have to work that well, when you have a city that is growing, you need to allow people to build more housing. And unfortunately, this is difficult. The people who live in that location usually don't want new stuff to be built because they're worried it might affect their property prices or change the nature of their environment. People also don't like new stuff because, oh, it'll cause traffic, it'll cause noise, it'll cause this. You have environmental groups who often oppose stuff because they say it'll hurt this frog or this pigeon or this lizard that lives in the environment, or it'll poison this river. And then you also have people who are already entrenched in the property market saying, well, we don't necessarily want new stuff to go up because that's only going to push our prices down. Anlu, do you agree with me that rent controls are not the right way to go here?
I 110% agree with you. I think Jordan, or Mayor Jordan Hill Lewis, provided a very good summary of the major issues with rent control, including the things that he mentioned, like it discouraging new construction or deferring maintenance. And at the end of the day, if a landlord can't afford the maintenance or upgrades, then it's simply not going to happen. There's no incentive for them to keep up their properties or to actually build new properties. If I mean, they only have a set amount that they can essentially get from it. But there's also something that I think was missing. I don't know, you can point out if I did miss it in the article, but one of the other major issues with rent control, which often go unnoticed, is the limits that it put on labor mobility, in the sense that people who think that they have a good opportunity now, they have a good property, they kind of get locked into where they are, and there might be much better opportunities for them somewhere else. So there's almost this feedback loop that forms where they also don't actually move up, whether it's in their careers or in income that they earn. They kind of stay stuck there with their property as well. And this has a negative effect at the end of the day. This meaning rent control has a negative effect on both the person who lives in that house, but also the landlord and the entire community surrounding them. I quite liked in our pre-show discussion as well, but he also mentioned it, that there's a few things that need to happen for supply of houses to increase. And he specifically mentioned that, well, being from the Free State myself and then moving to Cape Town, I'm also one of the immigrants into the Cape Town or the Western Cape. So I'm well aware.
We are the problem here.
Exactly. Very well aware that we are the problem.
We're driving the property prices up.
Exactly. Very, very well aware that we are the problem. But I have lived here now, I think, for 3 years, and I feel like the community accepts when I also bash foreigners for pushing up property prices. There is a lot. I think the article mentioned something like 100,000 people moving from the rest of South Africa into Cape Town over the past 3 years, which is a lot of people. That is a high number. And to accommodate those people, you need more houses. And something that is not really, I think, happening as well as it can potentially happen is actually spreading the density through the other suburban neighborhoods. And making sure that there's incentive for these people to not have to live in the city center itself. Now, what can be an incentive for these people, for people like you and I, Nick, to live in the surrounding neighborhoods? And one of the very, very important things is infrastructure. If you want people to live in the surrounding neighborhoods, you need to make sure that there's a good whether public transport service that can actually take the people between where they live and where they work. Because as it is, people mostly work in the city centers, or the majority of people rather work in city centers. And for them to have these more affordable options of housing in the surrounding areas, they need good infrastructure to actually commute between work and home. And that will also then incentivize people to build more in the surrounding neighborhoods and actually make use of the land value that is available in these neighborhoods as well. Close to where I live, there's quite a new neighborhood almost that is being put up of low-cost housing, but low-cost housing in the sense that it's all the buildings look exactly the same. It's high buildings, I'm assuming one or two bedroom flats. Maybe bachelors, not entirely sure. For people to be able to travel from here to city, they actually need to know that they will not spend 2 hours in the morning in traffic, because that's a big incentive for them to rather than live in a bachelor flat in city and complain about the rent if they can afford it. So I think at the end of the day, important for us to also deregulate the barriers that actually are in like a barrier to increasing the supply. It's important to.
If there's one criticism I have of this piece, is that it doesn't say that kind of explicitly. I mean, the phrase uses streamlining approvals, which, you know, what does that actually mean? And I think the reality is that planning laws are just generally too anti-development because of all those groups that I talked about who don't want development in new places.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think if you just think of, I am not a construction in the construction industry myself, but if you think of all the regulations that are like restricting construction, it takes a lot of time. There's quite a few regulatory processes that it needs to go through. And even just making some or changing something as simple as making sure that if it's one type of housing development, that there's one approval process for it, can already significantly increase the rate at which these construction projects are approved. And this will have major economic and social benefits.
Like construction mafias that drive the cost up even more.
Yeah, exactly. And by actually addressing these things, there's a very very legitimate opportunity to, yes, increase the supply of housing and to make sure that with the supply increase, which will have price benefits, but with that, there's benefits for the cost of, like, per unit cost of putting up low-cost housing, or at least lower-cost housing.
So let's talk briefly about Airbnbs. There's a lot of frustration with Airbnbs, I think, in Cape Town in particular. It's a hot tourist spot. They, rather than renting out properties that might have been rented out in the past on a longer-term basis are now being rented out on this very short-term basis for, you know, targeting tourists at these higher rates. And understandably, I mean, you know, even you and I think who are generally pretty free market are have a sort of grumbling about this. I mean, is this really a good idea that you have a huge number of these? And I think for me, as much as it doesn't feel good to have too many Airbnbs, you know, driving up these costs, I think at the end of the day, you can't. I mean, firstly, it's interesting here that one of the stats that Jordan Hill Lewis gives in this is talking about foreign ownership. By the way, he says it's only 2.1% of total ownership is foreign owned in Cape Town. And I think the reality is that, you know, something like an Airbnb, it definitely has costs, right? You don't have people. You were saying in our pre-show discussion, you know, you don't necessarily have people using all the infrastructure or the local stuff or going to the same shops. You told me a story about a thrift shop that had to move because there weren't people living around in that area. And that is not great, obviously. But on the flip side, there are benefits to these things. When tourists come in, they spend money on stupid curios that cost way too much money. They buy expensive foods and coffees that the locals aren't really that able to support just because they're too expensive. You have new opportunities for fancy restaurants to open up. You have jobs created for tour guides and musicians and entertainers and all that sort of thing. And I do think that it is, while it feels emotionally satisfying to sort of view neighborhoods or communities as having kind of unchanging characters, the reality is life and society works better when change is embraced. When you say, okay, well, you know, this suburb got very fancy, but this is a new suburb that's much more affordable. And if you allow building to happen, if you allow development to happen, that can sort of happen. It's like, okay, well, this is getting too expensive. So people move to this new place. And this new place has got all the things that they used to have in the old one. It's, you know, a little bit different, a different part of the city, but it's got the good stuff in it. It's got that thrift store can find its customers in that new place, for example. When you don't allow building, you do get people stuck in the situation where areas are getting too expensive and you can't afford them, but your options of where to move are not super great on the other hand. I don't know, your thoughts on all of that.
You will not convince me, Nicholas, that Airbnbs are good. I will have a lifelong feud with them. where I used to live, there was, I'm not joking, our street was not longer than 500 meters. There were 17 Airbnbs. 17. Both the neighbors on top and to our right were Airbnb guests. So every second week, there were new guests. And the reason I made that point earlier about not having that, it's almost like a form of tourism. Is the word gentrification? I think that's the correct word, where it's like changing to suit the environment is changing to suit that of the tourists and not the local
community.
Much
more expensive, basically.
Yeah, so it's much more expensive. But also, I mean, just that sense of, I know my neighbor next door, so if I have an issue, I can go talk to my neighbor, whereas now every 2 weeks I have a new neighbor. But I do admit that this is perhaps just my, I come from a very small town, and I might just have a very good memory of a small town and knowing my next door neighbors and that sense of community. So I do admit that. And I agree, it is important for people to embrace the change. There's no way of stopping it. And Jordan Lewis made this point very well, I think, when he said that it doesn't care about your emotions. It's true. It doesn't care whether I like to know my next door neighbor. It is going to happen. And it's much better to actually embrace the change. To the point of the thrift shop. The reason they had to move is not because there were no more people wanting to buy from them. It's a very lucrative, like this is a high-end thrift shop. It's because they couldn't find a property to operate out of. And that is the issue for me.
The rent.
Yes, but not even the rent. They were willing to pay twice the rent that these people offered. It's that they want to put up building blocks and they can't afford to put up an entire building block. I mean, what does a thrift shop do in a building block? So there's literally no people who want to rent them a spot. And it's important for us to still, I think, even in these tourist areas, to encourage small businesses like these. She caters for tourists. Whenever we went there, we also had to pay tourist prices. But I mean, it's a high-end thrift shop. But yeah, it was just, it's noticeable how many of these small businesses are being forced out of these neighborhoods. And I stand by my point that to have a well-functioning neighborhood and community, you want that sense of there's a school and people make use of the school. There's shops and people make use of the shops. But I also hear your point that perhaps there's other neighborhoods who now form in which that environment can now be formed, and that people should embrace it. There is no stopping it. So, but I will continue my feud with Airbnbs.
Yeah, look, I mean, all of this is kind of driven by these sort of underlying economic things, which is when you have, as Hugh Lewis says, you know, when you have success, when you have increasing demand, success is change, right? You're becoming more attractive, more wealthy, all these other things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is the downside of success. But I would say that the upsides in general are better. I'm the kind of guy who my interaction with my neighbors is opening the blinds when I hear a noise outside and staring through the crack for the most point. So, you know, I think in that sense, we may just have a difference in values, which is completely understandable and legitimate. You know, there should be places where people can feel more entrenched. But anyway, there's noise from my phone here.
I just want to say that's why it's important to, when you have these different values and you want a different environment, then you can move to that environment. And that's then better for you, instead of you having to.
Right. And by deregulating building and planning and that sort of thing, you create more spaces, more opportunities for different environments to be built. And, you know, people will move to the ones that they think are the best. What you don't want is this thing where people have no choices, where it's gentrification on one side and urban decay on the other and tough luck. That's the worst of all worlds. And I think in some ways in South Africa, we do have that. You know, the fact is, Cape Town is the only city that seems to be succeeding at the moment. And that's a really big problem because it means that people don't have other options. if you want to live sort of with reasonable municipal services, you have to move to Cape Town. If Joburg was working well, the pressure on Cape Town would be much less. If yep. Durban was working well, the pressure on Cape Town and Joburg would be much less. And I think this is why, at the end of the day, municipal governance is really important.
And okay, Eastern Cape were working better. I mean, it's a lovely place.
Right. Yeah, exactly. These things all sort of feed into each other. Okay, we've gone long. Thank you very much for your time and patience with my blathering, Anlu. And thank you to our audience. We hope you found the show interesting. We have one more topic, but we'll leave that for tomorrow because we've gone long. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. That's a wrap. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.